to the second case of the morning, which is number 011897, Chattanooga Manufacturing against Nike Incorporated. Why don't we give the folks a few minutes to clear out, okay? Thank you for waiting, Mr. McCallion. I think we can proceed now.
Good morning. May it please the court. The appellant's Chattanooga Manufacturing Company has been marketing women's casual wear garments since at least 1980 under the trade name Jordan, and continues to do so in the casual women's wear market. Now, starting in 1985, it's uncontested that Nike, in agreement with Michael Jordan, began marketing Michael Jordan-endorsed products, specifically starting with the Air Jordan basketball shoes, and gradually expanding from there into a wider market.
When now, did your clients start to make casual wear? Has there been an evolution in your own clients' line of products?
Minimal, Your Honor. Chattanooga has got into the business in at least 1980, and the record is clear that they have focused fundamentally, with a couple of detours, but fundamentally on women's casual wear of an upscale nature. Price-sensitive buyers, but women who want an upscale look. Women who do not want to wear garments that may be associated with athletic wear or sportswear. So when Nike began marketing Air Jordan basketball shoes, there was no harm, no foul to the Jordan mark owned by Chattanooga. And indeed, when that Air Jordan logo began to develop, and indeed a number of Michael Jordan, MJ, and other endorsed products started coming online, these were in the menswear, exclusively in the menswear athletic wear area, first basketball and generally sports, and then generally athletic wear, marketed specifically, undeniably, to primarily males, 18 to 25, primarily urban.
And when did Nike begin to drop the Air in the Jordan and simply use Jordan?
It was over a period of time, most likely, and again, I don't think the record is completely clear on this, but it would have occurred at least around the period of time, the 1990, when, however, the term Jordan was not used as a standalone logo, but indeed the term Jordan, as used by Nike, was linked with a what they call a Jumpman logo, which was superimposed upon it. Now, and they diversified their line, started to diversify their line of products into athletic wear, a broader range of accessories, and so forth. But it was not until at least 1997 when Nike made the affirmative decision to attempt to penetrate through vast investment of resources into the women's wear casual market. Now, how do we know that? Well, our client found out about it in approximately 1998 by visiting a Nike store and saw and has testified, and the record is clear, saw that the Jordan Nike garments were starting to be marketed outside the menswear area into womenswear, and immediately consulted with a
these
trademark
new products
attorney.
Or simply a new marketing strategy on the part of Nike?
Yes, and indeed.
Which one? Were they new products or a new marketing, simply a new marketing strategy for pre-existing products?
It was primarily it was really both. But we know that it was a new marketing strategy, and we know that because at the time that this action was commenced, and when our client consulted with counsel in the 1997-1998 period, he began to see reported in the press this marketing effort by Nike to market Michael Jordan and Michael and Jordan endorsed products into the women's wear area. What our client didn't know, but discovery in this case has established conclusively, which is that internal marketing documents within Nike showed that they had a very clear and articulated strategy to take Michael Jordan, who was one of his retirements, was around this period of time, from a sports icon into a fashion icon. The press reports in the record clearly show that while they had marketed him for his passion and expertise in basketball and sports generally, that he now had a passion for fashion. And indeed, he began showing up at Las Vegas fashion shows, targeted, in the words of Nike and in the words of the president of the Jordan brand division of Nike, Larry Miller, that Nike was now into a new area. They were going to surpass age, gender, and race, and market generally, not only to men, but to women and children as well.
Why would that be unforeseeable back in the late 80s as Michael Jordan's popularity continued to soar? They're marketing these products. Why would they not want to market to half of the world's population, not want to target women? I mean, it would seem to me if that product is getting, Jordan's products are getting more and more popular, that it would be foolish not to try to tap the other 50% of the world's population.
And indeed, they made that conscious decision and decided to devote a great deal of resources in 1997, 98, and 99 to that. Indeed, their marketing strategy talks in terms of a spectrum from menswear next year into unisex into the casual women's wear market. I won't go into a great deal of detail, but there is an appendix, confidential appendix, submitted to this court under seal. But I'll specifically refer the court to the marketing strategy documents without going into detail in public here. But for example, A314 of the confidential appendix sets forth these internal documents, making it clear what their strategy was. Now, why did our client not foresee this? Because up until that time,
and that's a general, I guess, the basis of the district judge's decision on latches here, that you act soon enough to protect whatever.
Exactly. The district court says there was an unreasonable lack of diligence on Chattanooga's part. And what the court confused, and case law would support our position for reversal, that the court wrongly focused on what Chattanooga knew, that Nike, in fact, was marketing Jordan products, that that is not the test. The real test is, when did Chattanooga sit on its rights by knowing that it had a cause of action, an enforceable action for infringement which had accrued? Infringement is not a theoretical cause of action. As the doctrine of progressive encroachment, which has been adopted by this court in Independent Nail and as interpreted by Kellogg in the Sixth Circuit, the real question is when the likelihood of infringement, of encroachment, the likelihood of confusion in the market looms large. And that did not loom large. The Sara Lee case tells us you may have a theoretical encroachment, somebody's using the Jordan mark, but if you move too quickly without commercial damages and a real effective cause of action, you can, Rule 11 may apply. There may be all kinds of things that may apply.
Is the progressive encroachment doctrine acceptable in reverse confusion cases like this one?
Yes, absolutely. The court went into great detail, about 15 pages below, on the issue of reverse confusion, and ultimately decided that that was an issue it couldn't decide, certainly at this stage of the litigation. But yes, reverse confusion certainly is applicable here, and progressive encroachment, the Hot Wax case, Kellogg's and others, will instruct us that the issue is at what point in time does a cause of action accrue? And a cause of action can only accrue when you have commercial damages and real effective encroachment. What we have here is, in 1997, the launching of a Jordan Brands division with a separate president, but Michael Jordan listed and promoted as a CEO, kind of a new business guru, applying the same kind of ingenuity that he applied in sports now to business. He did not hold that was for marketing purposes primarily, but Michael Jordan was actively involved in all the marketing efforts at that particular time. Now, what the real basis for us being here and not in the district court, I think, arises from the court's decision on page 24's decision. It's in essay 24, where the court uncritically adapts an interpretation which the defendants or appellees here has put on an admission, supposedly, by the plaintiff. Admission number 35, I believe it is. What the court says is that, as defendants point out, it is undisputed that since 1985, Nike has sold Jordan T-shirts, etc. And as Chattanooga admitted in discovery, could be worn by women, and refers to defendants' arguments. And then admission number 35. But what the court is overlooking, and we ask this court to consider, is that in the record at A57 and 58, clearly the demands for admissions are clearly set forth, and what they, each one of them says, 35, 36, and 37, is admit as to which items could be worn by women, as that phrase is being used in your response to Nike's interrogatory number 3. Now, if you go to interrogatory number 3, and I ask the court's indulgence because it's really the basis of the court's dismissal here, in answer to interrogatory number 3, our client, the plaintiff, appellant, states, it was not, however, until mid-1998 that Mr. Moenian, the president of Chattanooga, while assessing the products of a Nike store in Midtown Manhattan, first discovered that the term Jordan was being used in combination with a so-called jump logo depicting the silhouette of a basketball player in the midst of a jump shot, to identify apparel that could be worn by women. The date, mid-1998. The admissions 35, 36, and 37, which do confirm that the Nike product could be worn by women, is specifically in the context of this mid-1998 discovery by Chattanooga that indeed products which could theoretically have been worn by women, and, you know, court to take judicial notice that women sometimes may put on a man's sweatsuit, but it wasn't until this 1997-1998 period that Nike made the affirmative decision to go into our market, the casual women's wear market. And that is the basis for the court's confusion below, and we believe that a remand would be warranted so that a further inquiry could take place. Now, the district court, although it was confused by defendants' representations as to plaintiffs' admissions, recognized the district court in its decision that the Nike Jordans brand was expanding, indeed, more aggressively into new markets, including the women's wear market. Now, where we believe the court erred was that instead of drawing reasonable inferences in Chattanooga's favor, the district court latched onto the defendant's interpretation of Chattanooga's admission, referring to could be worn by women. I see the light is on. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. McCullough.
Thank you.
We're here now for Mr. Zwinker.
May it please the court, my name is Alan Delinka. I represent Nike. Mr. Sperling will speak on behalf of the issues related solely to Mr. Jordan. The key issue here, I think, was already approached by one of the questions from the panel, and that's the foreseeability to Chattanooga of Nike's activity. And in light of that foreseeability, the lack of any activity on the part of Chattanooga for years. This court in the Illinois High School...
It may have looked a little silly bringing a lawsuit back in 1986-87.
Well, I'm not necessarily suggesting that they needed to bring a lawsuit for laches to have applied in any case. I think Mr. McCallion's emphasis in language that says the claim has to accrue, it's Nike's position in this litigation and in the summary judgment motion that there still isn't a claim today, that there's still no likelihood of confusion, and in fact, as Judge Castillo pointed out, there was no significant actual confusion in this case. And so to say...
That might be, but that's not... Then you'd be asking us to affirm on a different basis. The district court kicked this case on laches.
Well, we do ask the court to affirm on several different bases, and all of those bases we believe are sustainable in the record. But the question of foreseeability is, particularly in the IHSA case, when this court wrote, a serious trademark holder is assiduous in endeavoring to convince dictionary editors, magazine and newspaper editors, journalists, columns, and so on, to use their trademark appropriately. And Mr. Monian, who's the plaintiff's principal, has testified in this case that he sees that everything that uses the word Jordan is an infringement of his mark. And though he's a layperson, when you couple what this court has said about the seriousness of protecting your trademarks with this court's ruling in the Safeway case, which says that a party is responsible for that which they would have known had due inquiry been made.
If Chattanooga would have come to you in 1988-89, but what do we do about this Michael Jordan thing? What would you advise them to do?
Well, it's hard to look back on it at this point, but my client certainly at that point, and this is where the prejudice aspect of the laches analysis comes in, my client at that point certainly would have been on some notice that this Jordan trademark was out there. They weren't registered back then. They weren't, in their own words, very big back then either. But Nike was out there promoting everything under the name Jordan Hats, Jordan Caps. And if you look in the record, the exhibits show that as far back as that, we were already promoting it. Nike would have had an opportunity, if there was a legitimate dispute at the time, to do something different. And to figure out whether there was a dispute at the time or not, I think is next to impossible in a case like this, because the whole principle that they're now advancing on appeal, which frankly I don't believe they proposed in the district court with this progressive encroachment theory, is that the likelihood of confusion needs to loom large at some point in time. And on this record, the plaintiff has done nothing to show that the significance of the possibility of a likelihood of confusion, which I think goes way beyond the standard that this court has put forward anyway, but they haven't shown that the possibility has gone up. All they've shown is that Mr. Monian's sense of what was out there has changed. And Mr. Monian's sense of what's out there goes contrary to what the facts are here, which is women could have reasonably worn the Michael Jordan endorsed Nike products that Nike put out on the market as far back as 1990, at least, if not 85. The exhibit to Ms. Kiefer's declaration in support of our motion for summary judgment shows as early as 1990, Nike is calling products Jordan shirts, Jordan jackets. And that seems to be the thrust of their complaint, that there's clothing out there that could be worn by women. And that stuff has been on the market, frankly, without any question since 1990. And as Judge Castillo observed, the press was calling everything associated with Michael Jordan, Michael Jordan, whatever, Jordan hats, Jordan shirts, Jordan cologne, whatever it was. If the plaintiff was serious about its rights, it should have taken some action. And the fact that it didn't meant that parties like Nike and Michael Jordan were prejudiced by a lawsuit brought 10 years after the fact, almost three times, as Judge Castillo held, longer than the most applicable statute of limitations. But as Your Honor points out in terms of affirming on another ground, the IHSA case that I refer to is a case that this court handed down where it exerted the dual-use doctrine, which says that once a word serves the purpose of no longer identifying only the trademark owner, but also means something else. And in that case, it was the phrase March Madness, where the term March Madness not only referred to the Illinois High School Association's basketball tournament, but because of press and popular usage, referred to the NCAA, the plaintiff could not bring a claim against the licensee of the NCAA. And it's the same situation here, where, again, because Chattanooga didn't do anything for all of those years, the press, the public, has come to identify Michael Jordan with the word Jordan. And as we pointed out through the press clippings that we submitted and are in the record, and even one encyclopedia entry, the word Jordan has come to mean anything that Michael Jordan endorses. People, when they hear the word Jordan, think of Michael Jordan. And so there is no particular there's no particular remedy left for the plaintiff because they sat on whatever rights they may have had. The final point I would add, Your Honors, is that Chattanooga admitted in the complaint that the confusion that they fear out there is due to Mr. Jordan's fame. That's paragraph 14 of the complaint. And in paragraph 14 of the complaint, they said Mr. Jordan's fame causes the confusion that they're afraid of going forward. Well, none of the cases in this circuit, or any that we've been able to locate through our research, have ever held that fame in and of itself is an actionable tort. In fact, it's usually encouraged in our society. Mr. Jordan's fame causing the confusion doesn't fit within any of the categories of a likelihood of confusion analysis from a trademark standpoint. And the fact that they admit that Mr. Jordan's extraordinary fame causes the confusion creates a real problem when you're trying to find whether a trademark claim even exists for them. If Mr. Jordan's fame is causing confusion, they've run the same risk that any party runs when they adopt a mark of a name. By choosing Jordan, which the district court held wasn't primarily merely a surname, but by choosing a mark that was a surname and also a first name, they run the risk of people adopting that name for something else because of it being a surname. Even if Michael Jordan had never sold or endorsed one piece of clothing, the possibility of the claims that plaintiff brings today would still have been there. And yet, plaintiff did nothing. The plaintiff didn't do anything until 1997, And even then, they didn't contact Nike. What they did in 1997 was they ran off to the trademark office to register their trademark. Again, they didn't write Nike, they didn't write Michael Jordan and say, you know, we have a problem here. They went to the trademark office, went through processes in the trademark office until 1998, and then in 1998 they finally wrote a letter. And 1998 is well after Nike had spent $1 million plus a year for 15 years endorsing this concept of Michael Jordan and the merchandise he endorses from Nike. Now, another question that the panel asked was about the appropriateness of reverse confusion and progressive encroachment and how those two can play together. And I would submit that they can't work together very well given the sort of allegations the plaintiff has made in this case. The plaintiff's allegations in the complaint were that a massive ongoing advertising campaign had harmed their ability to use their mark. Now, again, putting aside our dispute over whether or not there was ever any injury, if there was a massive ongoing advertising campaign that concerned them, which is fundamentally what Sans Taylor talks about, in Sans Taylor, the plaintiff immediately came forward and said to the defendant, your ad campaign is causing me harm. The massive advertising campaign that Nike engaged in goes back to when Nike signed Michael Jordan as an endorser in 1984 and introduced the first line of products. And again, I would correct Mr. McCallion that the first line of products wasn't just shoes. Apparel has always been a part of the line that Nike has sold under the Michael Jordan endorsement. Now, it's true that the line has gone from athletic to more athleisure, but as the testimony in the record clearly shows, the merchandise that Nike has always sold under the Michael Jordan endorsement has always had this athletic feel to it. It's always been consistent for the entire length of the relationship. The final issue that Nike presents on this appeal is the matter of its counterclaims. And as we've argued in our brief, the existence of the claims that Chattanooga continues to make that there is some potential or theoretical harm out there when juxtaposed to the evidence that Nike put forward that their trademark was improvidently granted and is invalid means that the issue is not moot. Or at best, if it is moot, it's not the sort of issue that Nike should be precluded from raising again should there ever be a ripening. And I guess now that I've looked at my notes one more time, there was one other point. Mr. McCallion focuses a lot of his attention on request for admission number 35 and the district court's reliance on it. And as a first matter, I will note that in the district court's opinion, the court does not continue the entire citation that Nike had given to evidence, which we hold makes the evidence as clear as we've submitted here. What I'm trying to say is the evidence in support of the admission that Chattanooga knew that Nike was always selling clothing that could be worn by women is that the admission in request for admission number 35, which says the whole host of categories could be worn by women. Now, they've tried to extend that and say, well, what they meant was in 1997, and as we've explained in our brief, the point on summary judgment, of course, is whether there is a likelihood, no, I'm sorry, the point we raised in the brief was whether a reasonable jury could conclude that in 1990 or earlier, the sort of clothing could reasonably be worn by women. That is the reasonable inference to be drawn. The inferences they try to have the court draw that nobody can figure out what somebody else would have done back in 1990 is not a reasonable or justified inference, which is what this court requires. They're suggesting the court drew impermissible inferences, and the record simply doesn't support that.
Let me get back to that counterclaim just for a second. Is your primary beef about that the judge dismissed that as moot with prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if it was without prejudice, you wouldn't have any problem.
Well, we don't believe that the issue is truly moot, given the plaintiff's stance and the plaintiff's position on appeal. But to the extent that it may be moot, then the real issue is that a with prejudice determination has the ring of a determination on the merits, and particularly as to the primarily merely a surname issue, the district court found that that was a question of fact, so at least that issue is open, and the judge made no other determination on the merits as to the other issues. So in summary, Your Honors, the court should follow the district court's opinion because the district court's opinion follows the Hot Wax decision of this court, which says laches bars a claim when the plaintiff has sat on rights that, that they've known about it. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. DeLinker. We'll hear now from Mr. Sperling.
May it please the Court, I'm Fred Sperling, and I represent Michael Jordan. The District Court's entry of summary judgment for Michael Jordan must be affirmed because Chattanooga waived its appeal of one of the District Court's two alternative grounds for dismissing the claims against Mr. Jordan. Now, the District Court granted summary judgment to both Nike and Mr. Jordan on the issue of laches, but in addition, it ruled that even if laches didn't apply in this case, Chattanooga's claims against Mr. Jordan individually would not withstand summary judgment. Since Chattanooga failed to argue in its opening brief that the District Court's ruling was incorrect and should be reversed, Chattanooga's waived this issue on appeal, and the District Court's entry of summary judgment for Mr. Jordan should be affirmed. As this Court has clearly stated, for example, in the 1998 Calder case, we consistently have held that a party's failure to address a claim in its opening brief results in a waiver of that issue. Moreover, in situations in which there's one or more alternative holdings on an issue, that's this case, we've stated that failure to address one of the holdings results in a waiver of any claim of error with respect to the court's decision on that issue. That's precisely the situation we have here. Now, Chattanooga's reply, much like its argument to the court this morning, ignores the waiver cases from this court that were cited in Mr. Jordan's response and argues instead that the District Court's ruling on the issue of Mr. Jordan's individual liability ought to be ignored because it's dicta, and that this court lacks jurisdiction to consider it. First of all, both Chattanooga and Mr. Jordan in their motions for summary judgment addressed this issue at length and in detail. And after ruling that laches barred Chattanooga's claims as to both Nike and Mr. Jordan, the District Court went on to address whether Mr. Jordan could be individually liable to Chattanooga for Nike's alleged acts of infringement. And after summarizing the party's arguments and citing the relevant case law, the District Court squarely held that Chattanooga had not been able to establish the facts necessary to sustain a claim for individual liability. Now, Chattanooga now argues, in its response, not in its initial brief, that the District Court's holding is dicta because it's in a footnote. But this court has pointed out in the 1998 Bloom case that even the United States Supreme Court includes its holdings in footnotes. The key point, the point that Chattanooga ignores, is that the District Court clearly set forth the undisputed facts relating to this issue and applied the law to those facts. As a fallback, Chattanooga argues that the District Court's ruling is dicta because the District Court that said, even if laches doesn't apply, Chattanooga's claims against Michael Jordan would not withstand summary judgment. In other words, they complain about the use of the subjunctive tense. But this court rejected a strikingly similar argument in the 1990 Landstrom case, in which the District Court held that even if something were viewed differently, it would still fail. Indeed, in that case, this court upheld a claim of waiver as well. Chattanooga next argues that even if the District Court's ruling wasn't dicta and constituted a reviewable holding, it was framed improperly for review and shouldn't be considered by this court. But it was Chattanooga that appealed from the District Court's final judgment and clearly identified that judgment as having granted summary judgment in favor of both defendants. Mr. Jordan didn't file an appeal in this case because there was nothing from which to appeal. He had prevailed. Finally, even if Chattanooga hadn't waived the issue of Mr. Jordan's individual liability, the District Court's order should be affirmed because Chattanooga's claim against Mr. Jordan is completely without evidentiary support. A series of witnesses, without dispute in the record, testified that Mr. Jordan is not a Nike officer or a member of the board of directors. He doesn't have the authority of an officer or director. He doesn't have the authority to hire or fire employees. He doesn't have the authority to approve or disapprove budgets. And he doesn't have the authority to bind Nike or its Jordan brand division. Under these facts, Chattanooga doesn't come close to satisfying the special showing required in this court's precedent of Dangler. Now, alternatively, at the last moment in the District Court, Chattanooga argued, and now argues in its reply brief here, that Mr. Jordan ought to be considered a partner with Nike and thus vicariously liable. But this fails as well because Chattanooga's offered no evidence that Nike and Mr. Jordan ever held themselves out as partners or that either has the authority to bind the other. You were told in Mr. McCallion's argument that Mr. Jordan was listed and promoted as a CEO for marketing purposes. There was a tongue-in-cheek commercial, and it is part of the record as a video, in which Michael Jordan, during halftime, races over to an office, sits in the chairman's chair, and individually inspects shoes and places inspection stickers inside those shoes. That's the tongue-in-cheek marketing depicting Michael Jordan as the CEO. Clearly, that doesn't hold Michael Jordan out as able to bind Nike. So in summary, the undisputed evidence demonstrates that Mr. Jordan wasn't an officer or director of Nike. He exercised no authority of an officer or director. And there's no evidence that he was a partner of Nike or that Mr. Jordan and Nike held themselves out as partners. He was simply an endorser. What Chattanooga seeks is to convert every endorser into a person who is individually liable for trademark purposes, and there's no support in the law for that proposition. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sperling. Mr. McCallion, you have 3 minutes.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that counsel's reference to the tongue-in-cheek advertisement does not do justice to Michael Jordan himself, and indeed the record is clear. I refer to A467, for example. That is part of the 1997 through 1999 marketing effort of Nike to keep Mr. Michael Jordan viable as a product endorser. They very consciously attempted to morph him from a sports star to a business and fashion icon. I refer to A467, news article, The Guardian newspaper, September 10, 1997. But now, in an agreement reached with the corporation itself, Jordan will become head of his own division within Nike, the first time that a team player has turned himself into a brand on such a vast scale. The deal is a coup for both Michael, for Jordan and for Nike. This is repeated in both the written press as well as in news media blurbs, videos that were distributed by Nike. Just one more, the record is replete, A458. Featuring the familiar Jumpman logo, the Jordan brand features premium, high-performance sports apparel, footwear, and accessories for men, women, and children, inspired by the passion, vision, and direct involvement of Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan has been deeply involved with the design of everything he has worn from Nike since the relationship began in 1984, launching the signature brand in October 1997 with an evolution of this relationship. You believe that it's dispositive, that the record is dispositive, and the court's reference in footnote 17 to the lack of evidence on Michael Jordan's involvement, specifically in the marketing effort of Nike to move into the casual and women's wear market, it is not correct, and certainly to the extent there's any ambiguity should be construed in favor of the plaintiff appellant. With regard to that footnote 17, to put the district court's decision in context, we had approximately 15 pages applied to a very detailed analysis of reverse confusion, and the court declining to grant summary judgment on that particular issue and permitting it to go ahead. What we have here in a footnote, it's not just because it's in a footnote, and not just because it's in the subjunctive would. There's no factual analysis involved, and it is uncharacteristic of the decision itself that the court below would consider it anything other than just a theoretical aside to be decided by the court upon remand. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. McCallion. Indeed, our thanks to all counsel this morning. The case will be taken under advisement.